Welcome. You're listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. We're Sandy and Ron Fraser, talking today about the life of Baha'u'llah. One of the listeners in Texas, John, asked that we give a little bit of the details of Baha'u'llah's life, and I realized that we hadn't really talked about the life of Baha'u'llah very much. So, John, today is the day.
Thank you, John.
Baha'u'llah was born in 1817 in Tehran, the capital of Persia. His father was a very, very wealthy man, a vizier. That's a little bit like a governor, but it's an appointed position by the Shah. It's not an elected position. His mother was a direct descendant of Abraham. He spent much of his childhood in the mountains south of the Caspian Sea, in an area known as Mazinderan, and that's the area where his father was the governor. There's a couple of cute stories that indicate how precocious Baha'u'llah was. He'd never gone to school. His father probably had tutors come in and teach him to read and write and a little bit of the Quran, you know, maybe some music, some things that rich sons would normally learn, but not really any academics. And we know that he dropped into the religious schools from time to time to sit and listen to lectures. But that was about it. When he was about 10 years old, there was a tax collector in the area that was cheating his father. These tax collectors were a little more like robbers than tax collectors. The money they collected didn't necessarily go to the government. Some of it did, I suppose, or they would have lost their jobs, but they basically could just take whatever they wanted from these people. And he had cheated Baha'u'llah's father once, and it worked out so well, he decided to go back and cheat him again. So this time Baha'u'llah took him to court and got the matter resolved and got the tax collector fired. And that's when he was just 10 years old.
So seeking justice, even at 10 years old, my goodness.
Yeah. Another time, he was probably about 13 years old at this time, there was this Sufi leader that had a religious school, and he had lots and lots of students, and he was lecturing one day, basically lecturing on how spiritual he himself was. And he said that he was so detached from the world that if a messenger came and said that Jesus Christ himself was standing outside the door, he wouldn't feel compelled to meet Jesus. And Baha'u'llah raised his hand and asked if he could ask a question. And the man said, yes, go ahead. And he said, if instead of Jesus Christ, the messenger said that several of the Shah's executioners were outside the door and wished to speak to you, would you also be unconcerned? The religious leader thought for a moment. He said, well, in truth, I would be concerned if there were executioners outside the door. So Baha'u'llah said, if that is the case, then you shouldn't have made your previous claim. Another time, in another religious school, he was listening to this man present a difficult question to his students. I don't remember the exact question, but it had to do with the relationship between Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad, and Mary, the mother of Jesus. Religious students were all scratching their heads. None of them had an answer. So Baha'u'llah asked if he could answer the question. And he gave this beautiful explanation on a very spiritual level and amazed everyone, amazed the teacher. And then the teacher addressed his own students and said how disappointed he was that here he's lectured to them for months and months, and none of them were able to answer this question. And here this little boy walks in off the street and gives them such a beautiful answer.
From the mouths of babes, huh?
Yes. Baha'u'llah was about 18 years old when he got married. This was in 1835. His older sister had arranged the marriage. She was married at that time, and her husband had a younger sister that was a very sweet, pretty young girl. We know she had blue eyes. We know very little about her. Her name was Asiya. Asiya Khanum, we call her. Khanum is a term for lady, so we're Lady Asiya. She was from a very wealthy family also. It took quite a number of, if I remember right, it was like 20 mules to carry her clothes and furniture and whatnot to Baha'u'llah's house when they got married. And later when they were destitute after sometime after 1850, when the Muslims had taken all of their possessions, she used the golden buttons from her wedding dress to buy food for the family.
Hmm.
So it must have been quite a dress to have gold buttons. So Baha'u'llah gets married. We don't know too much about what goes on between 1835, in terms of his personal life, between 1835 and 1844. 1844, he's 27 years old. Two big things happen. One is the Baha'i faith gets started. There was a person who we call the Bab, that's B-A-B. He was also a messenger of God, something like John the Baptist was to Christ. He was a, you know, John the Baptist was the forerunner. He announced that there was this, you know, the Messiah was coming and to prepare the way for Christ's coming. And this was something like the purpose of the Bab. If you read his writings, they're all about this great messenger that was about to appear on earth. The other important thing that happened in 1844 was Baha'u'llah's first son was born, Abdu'l-Baha.
And there are lots of stories about Abdu'l-Baha, but
right,
we'll have to
right,
save
right.
that for another
Yeah, some other
broadcast.
Time we can tell all the wonderful stories about Abdu'l-Baha. We really know a lot more about Abdu'l-Baha than we do about Baha'u'llah, because Baha'u'llah, since he spent his life in prison, his life was pretty much just, you know, being in prison and writing, whereas Abdu'l-Baha was out in public interacting with people much more. So as we said, we'll get to Abdu'l-Baha some other time. Okay, so let's fast forward to 1850. Baha'u'llah is now 33 years old. The Bab is martyred, killed by a firing squad of 750 soldiers in July of 1850.
During their second attempt.
Yes, of course we could spend another podcast talking about the Bab. That's a pretty interesting story, but I don't think we've got the time today to
have
go.
Have to stay focused.
Yeah, that would be a long story to do the justice to that story. Okay, so 1850, the Bab is martyred, and there's just a tremendous amount of upheaval. Lots and lots of Baha'is are being killed. I want to focus more on the personal stories of Baha'u'llah rather than the history of the Baha'i faith. There's a cute story that happened right around 1850 involving Abdu'l-Baha. Now, Abdu'l-Baha at this time is just 6 years old, and he hears that his father has thousands and thousands of sheep up in the mountains, and he wants to see them. So Baha'u'llah asks one of the servants to take Abdu'l-Baha up into the mountains and show him the sheep. So they get up there. The shepherds are delighted to see Abdu'l-Baha, and they pool their lunches together and make a little party for him, and they all have a good time. And then Abdu'l-Baha needs to leave. And the servant that took him up there says to Abdu'l-Baha that there should be a gift for the servants because it's a tradition. And Abdu'l-Baha said, "I'm sorry, but I didn't bring anything at all with me." And the servant says, "Well, you know, it wouldn't be right for there not to be a gift." So Abdu'l-Baha gave them all the sheep.
He was resourceful, wasn't he?
Yeah, so these shepherds suddenly are very, very wealthy men. The servant takes Abdu'l-Baha back to Baha'u'llah, tells Baha'u'llah that Abdu'l-Baha has given away all of his sheep, and Baha'u'llah just laughed. He says, "We'll have to protect Abdu'l-Baha from himself. One of these days, he'll give himself away." Now, by this time, let's see, they have been married for 15 years. Baha'u'llah's been married for 15 years at this point. Baha'u'llah and his wife, Asiya, were known as the mother of the poor and the father of the poor. They were known to help anyone that came to them for help. They would give money, they would send people food, they would take care of doctor bills. They would do whatever they could for these people that lived around them in the mountains of Mazinderan. The family of Asiya and the family of Baha'u'llah were both concerned that they were giving away their wealth too quickly, that they would become poor themselves. Of course, Baha'u'llah knew that he would quickly be stripped of all of his possessions. It didn't really matter. He knew that the money and whatever he was giving to these poor people would at least be of some use to them, and it wasn't going to be of any great use to the people that were going to rob him in a few years. In 1852, there was a terrible thing happened. These two crazy young Baha'i men decided that they were going to kill the Shah. They didn't ask anybody if this was a good idea, and they went about it in such a stupid way. Instead of using a proper rifle or pistol, they used this tiny little gun that was used for shooting small birds. So they did manage to sneak up on the Shah while he was hunting, and they actually shot him with this little gun, but instead of wounding him, it sort of gave him a skin irritation. These pellets were so small, and the gun itself was so weak that it really didn't do any harm. But it did manage to get the two men killed immediately. The Shah's guards killed both of them instantly. The big result of that was that the Shah's mother became furious, and she decided that all the Baha'is had to be killed. Every single one of them. She was just was going to have no more of that.
I think they thought that the sole person behind the plot was Baha'u'llah, when really it was not, you know.
Baha'u'llah was understood to be sort of the leader of the Baha'is, so it was assumed that he was behind this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was a problem in
killing... Which he wasn't, but...
There was a problem in killing Baha'u'llah because one of his relatives was married to a Russian diplomat. So he sort of had the protection of the Russian government, and because of that and because of the esteem that he enjoyed from the people in general. I mean, he by this time he was really very well known as this great spiritual leader. They were unable to actually kill him, so they put him into this thing called the Black Pit, Siya Shah. We talk about it being a prison, but it wasn't literally a prison. What it was a cistern, a water storage tank underground for one of the palaces. And it wasn't used for that purpose any. It hadn't been used as a cistern for years, but it was just this big stone pit. Had no doors, no windows.
No light.
No light. There was just a single door up above at street level and a long staircase coming down to the bottom. In there, they put 150 people. Now, most of them were Baha'is, but there were some other people that weren't Baha'is. These were all people that were waiting to be executed. They were all chained together, collars, steel collars around their necks and heavy chains. The chains were so heavy that Baha'u'llah's back was crushed, and he had trouble for the rest of his life with aftermath of that. His back was kind of hunched over from the damage. His hair turned completely white while he was there. He was in the pit for 4 months. So it's really impossible for us to imagine or describe how bad that was. There's no ventilation. This isn't a situation where you can raise your hand and ask to go to the bathroom. You know, whatever the men had to do, they just did right where they were. And there was rats and fleas and roaches. It's just impossible to describe how bad this is. And to be stuck in there for 4 months. Now, we know that he did get out to get some exercise. I don't know if they took them out every day for exercise or if it wasn't maybe every day, but it was pretty bad. Now, just before he went into the Siya Shah, I need to backtrack just a little bit, he suffered what's called the bastinado. This is a torture. And the reason why he was bastinadoed was that some of the Baha'is were supposed to be killed. Baha'u'llah asked that he receive the punishment instead of them. Since they couldn't kill him, they did the bastinado. Now, what that is, they lay the person on their back, they tie their ankles to a wooden rod, which is held on either end by two people, so the person can't move their feet. And then a third person takes a wooden rod and beats the bottom of the feet until they're bloody. It's an extremely painful thing to happen to you. So that was done before Baha'u'llah was put into the Sea of Shaal. So his feet are in terrible condition, but he did have shoes. And a very touching story was that sometime during this 4 months, he sees this, one of the 150 people were being taken out to be executed, and he saw that this boy didn't have any shoes, and he didn't want the boy to die in without dignity. So he gave the boy his shoes. And of course, that means that Baha'u'llah's feet have to be down in all of this filth and vermin for the rest of the time that he's in the Sea of Shaal.
I don't think I've ever heard that story of the boy without the shoes and giving away his shoes.
Yeah, it's very touching.
Oh, yes.
Another thing that happened, the Shah one night heard this eerie sound, and he asked what the sound was. And he was told it was the Baha'is in the Sea of Shaal singing. The song they were singing, Baha'u'llah made up the verses and taught the people to sing. So all 150 prisoners in this deep stone hole in the ground are singing this song, and the sound is coming up out of the ground. These were the words that they were singing.
God is sufficient unto me. He is the all-sufficing. In him let the trusting trust. In him let the trusting trust. And they would sing that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And we've learned this song. It's a beautiful song, very touching to our hearts. It's Baha'is.
After 4 months, Baha'u'llah is released from the Sea of Shaal and exiled to Baghdad. In January, which is, of course, winter time, they leave on this journey through the snowy mountains that separate Iran and Iraq. It takes them until April so it's a 3 month journey to reach Baghdad. Abdul Baha's feet froze. You know, he's 9 years old at this time. His feet freeze, and he had trouble with his feet for the rest of his life. So this is the start of Baha'u'llah's being a prisoner of the Turkish government. So from 1853 to 1892, for the last 40 years of his life, he's a prisoner of the Turkish government.
You know, it's one thing when you suffer, and then it's also another thing when your whole family suffers you.
Yeah, his wife and of course she's from a wealthy family. She's not used to this kind of stuff. And here she is trudging through the snows and the mountains. And
a lot of hardship.
Right. She was pregnant at that time, too. And with two small children, a 9-year-old boy and I think a six or seven-year-old girl. And you know, you're not talking about it a nice heated SUV. You're talking horses. So it's just a miserable thing to contemplate. There's some interesting stories that show Baha'u'llah's approach to conflict, and some of the funny ones have to do with the assassination attempts. One of the clergy in Baghdad hired one of the local thugs to kill Baha'u'llah. So this poor guy decides he's going to sneak up on Baha'u'llah and throw a spear into his back while he's saying his prayers. And so he comes up behind Baha'u'llah and he pulls the spear back, and Baha'u'llah turns around and looks at him. And the man just gets rattled when he sees Baha'u'llah's face, and the spear falls out of his hand. So he gathers his wits about him, and he picks the spear up again and draws the spear back. And again, Baha'u'llah turns around and looks at him. And he drops the spear. So he gets he gets his nerve up again, and he's all determined. This time he's going to do it.
Third time's the charm.
So he pulls this, right, third time's the charm. So he pulls the spear back, and this time Baha'u'llah looks at him and smiles. And he just threw down the spear and said, "To heck with it. This just isn't going to work."
I've never heard that story either. Wow, yeah. I'm so glad.
And there was another guy who was hired to kill Baha'u'llah, and he walked up to Baha'u'llah with a pistol and just pointed the pistol right at Baha'u'llah's chest, and Baha'u'llah looked into his eyes, and the man just started shaking, and the pistol fell out of his hand, and Baha'u'llah asked one of the Baha'is to return the man's pistol and escort him back to his house. He seems to have lost his way. So there's a great story where Baha'u'llah and a number of the Baha'i men were in Baha'u'llah's house, you know, sitting around having tea, whatever, in the evening, and a messenger came bursting in the door saying that a crowd was coming to the house. They had torches and axes and shovels and swords, and they were going to attack the house. And a couple of the Baha'is there drew their swords, getting ready to protect Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah said, no, just put your swords away. Everything's going to be fine. So Baha'u'llah stood by the door, and as the crowd approached the door, he threw the doors of the house open and invited them all in to tea. And so this crowd of confused people came in into the house, and he served them tea, and he talked to them, and we don't know what he said exactly, but I'm sure he talked to them about spiritual things. And after they all had tea, they went back to the clergyman who had stirred them up, saying that these people were the enemies of Islam and they were, you know, terrible, terrible people. So they went back to have a word with that clergyman about all these terrible things he'd said about these wonderful people.
Like, and all the terrible things he's doing, like serving tea.
Yeah. So there was this time, I don't remember exactly when this happened, but it was in Baghdad, and at some point some soldiers were moving Baha'u'llah from one place to another, and they were doing this in a way that was degrading to him, so that the people would throw stones and garbage at him and that sort of thing. Baha'u'llah and these soldiers were moving fairly quickly, and there was this old lady that wanted to throw a stone at Baha'u'llah, and the soldier was moving Baha'u'llah along and preventing her from throwing the stone. And Baha'u'llah told this soldier to wait, to stop. He says, "Do not deny her what she deems to be acceptable in the sight of God." And so the soldier and Baha'u'llah stood there while the old lady threw the rock at him. He never showed really any care at all for his own personal well-being. Just like the story of the...
That's remarkable.
In the prison with the little boy in the shoes. You know, any other person would have protected his feet. His feet were already injured. You know, he would have had... Any other person would have had more concern for their own well-being rather than to share their shoes with this little boy who's... or this youth that's going to die right away anyway. You know, it's just amazing.
Well, I think that story with the lady, it just demonstrates, you know, that whole saying of, you know, thinking of others and whatever will bring joy to the other person's heart, mm-hmm. You know. He knew that that would bring that lady satisfaction, you know?
It was more important to him that that lady be happy than for him to suffer a little pain, you know?
It's just remarkable.
Amazing. So in Baghdad, in the 1850s, there were dozens of people claiming to be the new messenger of God. And Baha'u'llah didn't want to be in the position of arguing with them. So he just left. He went and lived in a cave in the mountains of Sulaymaniyah, which is on the border between Iran and Iraq, and just lived as a dervish for a few years. The cute story, while he's there, there was a little boy that he saw along the side of the road, and this little boy's crying. So he stops and asked him what was going on. And the little boy said that his teacher had given him some verses that were written out. And as a writing exercise, the little boy was supposed to copy these verses. And he'd lost the paper, and now he didn't have his homework, and he was afraid to go to his teacher. So Baha'u'llah took a piece of paper and wrote out in beautiful calligraphy some verses for the little boy to copy, and helped him make the copy. And so the little boy's happy, goes to his teacher, shows him the paper, and the teacher is shocked at how beautiful this writing is, and he recognizes that this isn't the writing of an ordinary person. He finds out from the little boy where Baha'u'llah is, and he goes and sees Baha'u'llah, and he tells other people, so the word slowly gets out that there's this great spiritual teacher. People are going to visit him. Religious students from the religious schools around the area are going to visit him. And
so people couldn't help being attracted.
Oh yeah, everywhere Baha'u'llah went, he attracted. Some of the Baha'i families that Sandy and I have met are descended from the jailers of Baha'u'llah. The people that hated Baha'u'llah were the people that never met him. You know, he would be put in prison or whatever, and the people that were directly associated with him were always in love with him and his family. So the little boy has started this ball rolling. The word is spreading. Eventually the word reaches Baghdad that there's this great spiritual teacher living in the mountains of Sulaymaniyah. The Baha'is realize that this is Baha'u'llah, so they send a couple of the Baha'is up there to try to bring him home. And he does, and by the time he gets back, these other people that were claiming to be the messenger of God have all pretty much made fools of themselves. And there aren't so many claiming. There's still probably one or two claiming to be a messenger of God. But Baha'u'llah is then easily able to become the leader again of the small Baha'i community in Baghdad. The Shiite clergy were always upset. They were upset in Iran, and once he moved to Baghdad, they were upset again. One thing they did was they were aware of, on some level at least, of, you know, he hadn't made at this time his public announcement that he was the messenger of God. But enough people knew that he was the messenger of God that the word had kind of gotten out that, you know, there was this new messenger of God. So these clergy send one of the mullahs to Baha'u'llah to tell him that they would like some proof. Well, Baha'u'llah tells them, you know, you really don't ask God for proof. But he would accept one miracle, that if they got together and consulted and agreed on one miracle that they wanted him to perform, he would perform that one miracle, and then they would all have to acknowledge that he was the new messenger from God.
So I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, so they argued among themselves for 3 days. They couldn't come up with anything that they were sure that he couldn't do. So they just gave up and went to the government and had him exiled to Constantinople, to Istanbul. So that's what happened. The government did announce that he was to be transferred to Istanbul.
And Istanbul was then considered Europe at that time? No.
No. Turkey.
Okay.
Has,
so he hasn't made it to Europe yet.
Yeah, part of Turkey is in Europe and part of it's in the Middle East.
Okay.
And Istanbul is right on the body of water that separates.
So word of him probably spread to Europe at that point.
Well, if not, it was about to.
Mm-hmm.
So they had another miserable journey. Nope, before I get into that, I just wanted to... So in April of 1863, he announces that he's the messenger of God for the next 1,000 years. This is in Baghdad just before he leaves on this journey. Okay, so now he's going to Istanbul. It's 110-day journey in the summer of 1863, and you know, you're talking about the summer in the desert. This isn't very pleasant either. So another grueling journey. He's only in Constantinople, Istanbul, for 4 months. The clergy again gets upset. You know, there's all these people that are pleased about him and the things he's saying, and the clergy feel threatened, so they decide to exile him again. So the governor or the sultan orders that he is exiled to Adrianople, which today is called Edirne, E-D-I-R-N-E. It's on the border with Bulgaria.
Ah, so that's Europe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So now he's in Europe. Okay. So we're going to stop there for today, and we'll.
Okay. So this is part one.
We'll pick up the story in Adrianople tomorrow. Thanks for listening. I hope this was helpful. And if you find this very interesting, I hope you'll find some of the books on Baha'u'llah's life. There was a book called Baha'u'llah, A King of Glory by Bayuzi, a history book written by Baha'u'llah's great-grandson called God Passes By, which is also excellent. There's a little book called Stories of Baha'u'llah by Furatan. All of those are available from the Baha'i Distribution Service. So, hope this helps. We'll see you tomorrow. And remember, you're welcome to join us at any time.
You've been listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. If you'd like to learn more about the Baha'i faith, call 1-800-22-UNITE, or in Florida, call 850-543-2129. Look on the internet at www.baha'i.org for the international site, or www.baha'i.us for the U.S. site. Remember that Baha'i is B-A-H-A-I. In Florida, our website is www.emeraldcoastbaha'is, that's with an S at the end, .org, emeraldcoastbaha'is.org. You can email me at panhandlebaha'is@aol.com. Thanks for listening.